The parties before us do not dispute that a former president can be subject to criminal prosecution for unofficial acts committed while in office. They also agree that some of the conduct described in the indictment includes actions taken by Trump in his unofficial capacity. They disagree, however, about whether a former president can be prosecuted for his official actions. That 2024 pronouncement from the U.S. Supreme Court set the stage for a lot of legal wrangling, and in the year to come, it will continue, and we will find out about that and some other cases which will be coming before the U.S. Supreme Court in 2025. Cases to watch for. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Howard Schwaber, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the UW-Madison, and welcome back to University of the Air.
Well, thanks for having me.
This may become an annual exercise, and I'm guessing there's going to be no lack of material, and maybe at the end of the year we should look back and see how some of these cases played out.
Comedians and legal commentators will never lack for material during this administration.
So it seems. One of the things that surprised me about cases before the Supreme Court in this year is that some of them may go all the way back to the time of Franklin D. Roosevelt, back when there were Supreme Court challenges to some of the regulatory agencies that he established during the New Deal. Are we actually seeing a fresh look at some of those things from back in the 1930s?
So that's the biggest question. So to back up just a second, in the last two terms, we've seen a number of decisions that point in that direction. The Supreme Court in the last two terms has done some truly radical things. Radical in this case, meaning a sharp change from the status quo. You know, when you talk about the court, usually you only use radical as an insult. So if you call something radical, it means you don't like it. And anything you do like, you say, no, that's normal. I don't mean it that way necessarily, although people can disagree. But certainly these decisions were radical in the sense that, for example, one particular decision from last year declared an end to what was called Chevron deference. And some people are tired of hearing about this. Some people have never heard of it. The short version is, for a very long time, it's been a kind of given that courts would defer to agencies when agencies had to figure out how far their mandate went. And so you think about something like the Food and Drug Administration. The Food and Drug Administration has a mandate to prevent harmful products from being in food. Okay, fair enough. How far does that go? What counts as a harmful product, right? Does it have to be poisonous, or is it enough that it's merely, I don't know, fattening, for example? So all of those kinds of questions, which obviously have huge consequences for rulemaking, aren't spelled out in the statute that, for example, created the FDA. So up until last year, for a good 50 years, the premise has been, as long as the agency is acting reasonably in interpreting its mandate, the courts aren't going to try and second guess. And the reason is that the agencies are staffed by experts. You don't necessarily want people whose only training is law school to be deciding questions of what constitutes a chemical pollutant that's sufficiently dangerous that it should be kept out of the water that children might drink. That's just not a question that lawyers are trained in.
So beyond the expertise of the Supreme Court, in other words.
Well, exactly. But not this court. The Roberts Court insists it has expertise on all questions. One of the striking things about this court is that they have no deference on questions of science or policy or history or anything else. They really seem to think of themselves as the ultimate experts on all questions. That's a real thread that runs through. And the way that thread plays out, and I realize some people will hear this as being sounding awfully provocative, but this is actually a commonplace observation among court watchers. And the way that plays out is the Supreme Court, with respect to agencies and also lots of other things, has said, we, the courts, should have the authority to second guess decisions by the so-called experts and decide for ourselves whether we think those decisions are reasonable. And that goes to legal questions, scientific questions. There's just a general, we will not defer the judgment of agencies. So an agency that is, let's say the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, says, I'm going to make this up now, but you know, there's a particular pollutant that's going into the air that's very bad for people. We want to ban it. And the Supreme Court says, well, we can decide whether that's a reasonable exercise of your authority or not. And if we think it's not, we're going to strike it down. And that's something we have not seen really since the 30s. Now, the open question is, how far does this go? And that question remains open. So last year, and this is a general pattern of, I think, all courts, but again, particularly of the Roberts Court. The Roberts Court in the last 3 or 4 years has created a habit of declaring really broad, sweeping, and often radical principles or changes in principle without giving any details as to exactly how far they go. I like to describe them as invitations to litigation. They're invitations to lawyers. Look, we've opened this door. See how far we'll let you go through it. Bring some cases. So this year, we're really watching to see cases in which the question will be asked, and we hope answered, you know, just how far does this go? And I've already talked about deference. The other question that goes back to the 30s is the independence of these agencies. Again, going back to the 30s, and frankly, even earlier, but especially in the New Deal, the question was, how much can regulatory agencies be designed by Congress to be independent of the president? Every time a new president is elected, especially if there's a change in party, there's a big change in policies. Should the new president be able to say, okay, now all the federal government's regulatory policies will change to accord with my election? Or should there be a model of independent agencies, going back to this idea of being staffed by scientific experts and so on, whose decisions should not be political? There, too, in the last 3 years, the Roberts Court has said the president should have much more authority to fire directors of agencies or dictate their policies than we thought was true for the last 50 years. So those two questions. What is the scope of discretion agencies will have when they're making rules? And how much will courts second-guess their judgment? And to what degree will agencies be allowed to be independent of a president as opposed to being answerable to the will of the executive? Those two big, big constitutional questions that absolutely go back to the 30s that we all thought were settled, and really not, you know, open to discussion as recently as 3 years ago, are now wide open. And already this term, we've seen a number of cases where people have accepted this invitation and brought cases saying, well, you should strike down the National Labor Relations Board and declare its existence unconstitutional. Or you should strike down the Consumer Finance Credit Protection Bureau, or you should, speaking you and the court, being the courts in this case, you should strike down this or that regulation. Thus far, the Supreme Court has not accepted a really major case. That is, they've been given several opportunities, including one just a couple weeks ago, where they were asked to rule on a lower court ruling. So there was an appeal from an injunction where people were trying to strike down the existence of an agency, an entire agency, and have it declared unconstitutional, and the court declined that one. So thus far, we're still in the stage of watching to see what cases will there be that ask these enormous questions. And as you absolutely correctly put it, these are almost 100 years old, these questions. These were settled in the 30s, and they are to some degree being reopened. And so the big question, and we don't know the answer yet, is this term, how much will the court do to answer the question of just how far will this revolution go?
Do these cases usually go through some kind of lower court first and come to the Supreme Court as an appeal? Or do any of them go directly to the Supreme Court if we're talking about separation of powers?
So there's another interesting thing about the Roberts Court, which makes it very different from previous courts. And I should point out, conservative previous courts, progressive previous courts, this is a difference in approach. The Roberts Court relies more than any court in modern history, maybe any court ever, on what's called a shadow docket. I know that sounds ominous. And in a way it is. The shadow docket refers to all the things that courts do that do not involve actual arguments of cases with briefs and lawyers and evidence, right? When we think of a legal proceeding as there's a trial of some sort, evidence is presented, a decision is reached, there's an appeal, lawyers argue about the appeal, legal principles are established. As you say, cases we think of reaching the Supreme Court from lower courts on appeal through that whole process. And historically, that's how big questions have been answered. The Roberts Court has been willing to answer really big, important questions about the kind of topics we've been talking about on something like an appeal from an injunction. And the reason that's so interesting is that in those rulings, there are no opinions. There's no explanation. Lawyers are never given a chance to write briefs. There's no argumentation. It's done completely in the dark. That's why it's called the shadow docket. It's done in private behind closed doors. And unless one of the justices dissents, there's no opinion at all. There's just an outcome. Sometimes there's a very, very short opinion that'll announce some very, sometimes major rule with no explanation and no opportunity for anyone to have argued about it. No role for the lawyers and the parties here. So to give you an example, there's something called the Purcell Rule, which is a rule that was created in the context of the last two electoral cycles, where the Supreme Court has decided they will not allow federal courts to change rules of elections or to strike down a state's rules for elections too close to the time of the election. Now, that is not necessarily a bad principle. I could see arguments about it. It can have troubling outcomes. For example, in 2020, for the first time, a state was allowed to have an electoral process that a court had found to be racially discriminatory, nonetheless be in operation for that election because of this rule. It was saying it was too close to the time of the election to make a change in rules. So, you know, it's controversial, at least. There are also a lot of controversies about the fact that it seems to be very inconsistent. In one instance, 6 weeks before the election was not too soon. In another instance, 9 months before the election was too soon. So the rule seems very inconsistent. But what's behind all of that is that the rule was never explained. No standards were established, no tests, no idea of what counts as too soon or how you decide that question. Lawyers were never getting a chance to argue whether this is constitutionally valid. None of the usual things that go with making law have anything to do with the so-called shadow docket, and that's where the Roberts Court does a lot of its work. So in the context that we're talking about, they have had and will have more opportunities to use shadow docket rulings to make these very consequential but uninformative opinions. So for example, imagine, and this is not implausible, that next month the Supreme Court upholds a lower court injunction, say from the Fifth Circuit, which is very politically conservative and lately very ideologically extreme, that declares a federal agency's structure to be unconstitutional, right? This question of how independent can the agencies be. If the Supreme Court just issues a ruling upholding the injunction, that's it. There will never be any explanation as to what their thinking was, how the rule applies to other cases, what the legal basis for the rule is, how this informs our understanding of the Constitution in general. So this court acts in ways that are very mysterious, very unexplained, and often very radical. It's an unsettling combination. That puts us in a position as watchers of the court this term, especially just sort of waiting to see what might happen. And at the moment, on the areas of separation of powers and agencies, you know, it's just hard to say. There are any number of controversies they could choose to use as the vehicle for announcing a new rule or explaining an earlier rule, or they could just keep going with these ad hoc shadow docket rulings on cases one at a time and leave everybody guessing.
They can do these shadow docket decisions on any case if they're unanimous? Is that how that works?
No, and unanimity is not required at all. Shadow docket decisions refer to cases involving court orders rather than suits. So you have the classic one is an injunction. Someone goes to court. So suppose someone files a lawsuit in a federal court challenging the constitutionality of something the government is doing. That's an ordinary lawsuit. They present evidence. At the end of that lawsuit, they ask for an injunction, and the lower court says, yes, we're going to issue an injunction. And it's one of the very unusual things about the American legal system is that any federal court anywhere can issue an injunction that binds the entire federal government.
Any federal judge anywhere.
So any federal judge anywhere can issue an order that says the entire national government as of today must stop doing whatever it is. Any federal judge anywhere. That's why appeals for injunctions are so urgent, and that's how this whole shadow docket thing came to be. It's a way of quickly getting to these very urgent questions, but it's been transformed into a vehicle for making really important rulings. So there is still probably an underlying case. And that case, whatever it was, may work its way through the courts, and the Supreme Court may or may not hear it. But in the meantime, you know, the damage has been done, so to speak, depending if you approve or disapprove of what they're doing. The action has been taken. And by the time, you know, it can take a year or 2 years, by the time the underlying cases reaches the court, we've seen a pattern where the court will then turn around, cite their own earlier decision on the shadow docket matter and say, well, we decided that question back then, so we don't need to argue it again now. It's a lot of bootstrapping. And it makes it all, it makes it much more difficult than it has been in past years with other courts to try and look at the terrain of currently pending cases and say, oh, yes, this is where a big question will be answered.
Do pending cases ever come before nominees for the Supreme Court in terms of how would you approach this case?
Sure. So that's a contentious question. In fact, in Wisconsin, it was a contentious question during the judicial election that led to Janet Protasiewicz taking the court. You may remember some of her opponents claimed it would be a conflict of interest because she'd expressed an opinion on questions such as, for example, abortion. Now, in that case, it was a very weak argument. I mean, Brad Schimmel has also expressed opinions on abortion. But the general principle, right, that we're concerned about is during the nomination process, it is considered improper for a nominee for the Supreme Court or any court to be asked, how would you rule in this case if it came before you? And so the dividing line is between what is your judicial philosophy? How do you feel about this particular issue? What's your constitutional approach to this kind of question? And that's all proper. And here's an actual case with actual parties. Which one will you favor? And that's improper.
Sure. Principle versus detailed.
The line can be blurry. Well, you asked a moment ago, can these cases, because they involve separation of powers, come straight to the U.S. Supreme Court? And you also asked, you know, can we know in advance what the nominees will answer on these questions? The answer to the first one is no. Cases that go straight to the Supreme Court, that's called original jurisdiction. And under the Constitution, there are only a very few categories, lawsuits from one state to another, for example, or foreign powers. There's a very narrow set of categories of cases that go straight to the Supreme Court. Although we may very well see in the next year or two or three a big case out of the West over water rights between the states, but that's for another time. All other cases must come up through the lower courts and be heard on appeal. As for the nominees, you know, in the last few decades, a lot of people have complained that the Supreme Court nomination process has become a joke because nominees know better than to answer any questions that really matter. And, you know, the best example, I think, I mean, the one that everyone comes back to is Clarence Thomas was asked his opinions about abortion as a nominee to U.S. Supreme Court, and he said, I have never seriously considered the question, which no one believed.
Yes, and this goes back a long way, and he's been on the court ever since.
It goes back a long way, and people argue it goes back to when Bork was denied a seat in the court. You can argue it goes back farther than that, but there has been, it's sort of a two sides of the same coin as the process has become more and more politicized.
And publicized,
yeah, absolutely. Nominees have learned to become more and more cautious about what they say during those hearings.
I have a question that pertains to the role of the Chief Justice and why we call these courts by the name of the Chief Justice, and we'll get to that shortly. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Howard Schwaber. We're doing as we have done from time to time over the last several years and looking at Supreme Court cases to watch in the coming year. And there will be plenty of them in the year 2025. And one of the big ones, which may take a while to play out or maybe not, Howard, you could tell us this whole business about government's role in social media.
Well, that's a big, big topic. And it will certainly take a while to play out. So what makes this whole set of issues so incredibly interesting is the combination of law, politics, and policy, and the way just everything meets together. So first of all, social media, right, are pervasive in our lives and omnipresent, but they are a different kind of technology from those that were used to before. And every time there's a major change in technology, especially technologies of communication, It takes a while for the law to catch up. Here you've got a lot of First Amendment questions, for example. There's an old principle that says you can't protect children from stuff that would be harmful to them by preventing adults from having access, right? So you can say stuff that is indecent can be kept away from children, but to achieve that goal, you can't say, therefore, it may not be produced anywhere. A very famous case out of Michigan many years ago called Butler versus Michigan, a Supreme Court justice said to ban material harmful to children and keep it away from adults in order to protect the children is burning down the house to roast the pig.
Famous essay from Jonathan Swift, I believe, or John DeQuincy, maybe.
it does sound like that, doesn't it? But of course, the whole idea that, well, we can keep things away from children while still leaving them available to adults gets much harder in the age of online media. And you could have an adult section of a library, but as everyone knows, it's a whole lot harder to segregate cyberspace that way. So there's a whole range of First Amendment issues involving cyberspace. Right now, Texas is working on adopting a law to prevent children's access to pornography. And a lot of people think it will have First Amendment problems. And it's not because anyone thinks that there's a really good argument for saying that 12-year-olds should be allowed to view hardcore pornography. That's not what anyone is arguing. The question is whether you can make the tests for what's an acceptable law under the traditional First Amendment standards, make those tests and standards make sense when applied to cyberspace. And it's very difficult. It's also very difficult because the justices notoriously have very little idea what they're talking about. There was a story I saw not long ago that pointed out that only some of the justices even use email to this day, which, you know, to my children is, email is an archaic technology that no one who's cool uses anymore anyway, right? I mean, so these are a bunch of, I mean, I'm sorry to put it this way, but elderly people who have not spent their careers keeping up on technology and technological change, who are extremely ill-informed, or seem to be from their questions and their statements, extremely ill-informed about how this stuff works, trying to answer these questions. That's one dimension. A second dimension is, and really well illustrated by the TikTok case, which is very much in the headlines right now, which the Supreme Court is getting ready to rule on right now. They just had oral arguments this past week. And this is a great example of why globalized cyberspace makes traditional constitutional tests just really, I don't want to say obsolete, but very difficult to apply. So the issue here is that TikTok is, as I suspect all your listeners know, probably better than me, it's a very popular social medium. It's run by a company called ByteDance, which is owned by the Chinese government. There are concerns that the Chinese government may be able to harvest the personal data that the TikTok site collects, and it collects a lot of personal data.
170 million subscribers, I think.
Well, it's not just the subscribers, but how much information about each one the site gets. And of course, that's an issue that goes beyond TikTok. Can we constitutionally use regulation to try and prevent online businesses from collecting all this information? Or is that somehow protected activity on their part, either as business activity or First Amendment activity? And it's not quite like, may a department store ask to see your driver's license before they accept your check, right? This is a level of information gathering that goes way beyond anything that previous technologies would have recognized. And that poses all kinds of challenges and threats that we're just not really terribly ready in the legal community to deal with. The TikTok level has issue has a national security element. Let's be blunt about this. We do not trust the Chinese. Many Americans and the American government does not trust the Chinese government. We can imagine, without very much effort, a situation in the next few years which is a direct confrontation between China and the United States. And if the Chinese government had direct access to 170 million users' online accounts and personas and could flood 170 million inboxes with misinformation, right, you can see all kinds of ways that the emerging categories of cyber warfare, which is another new area, you know, can become entangled in cyberspace, business, and social media.
Stephen Colbert already had a satire of somebody doing some kind of a stir-fry recipe from TikTok and then not so subliminally learning that, oh, yes, and while you're making this, just be aware that Taiwan belongs to mainland China.
Well, you know, Colbert is trying to be funny, but it needn't be nearly that funny. We have seen coordinated Russian-backed misinformation campaigns in both 2016 and the 2020 elections. There's been a lot of that kind of work. This is from North Korea as well. You know, and it needn't be a subliminal message in a stir fry recipe. Colbert is making it sound funny, like, oh, that would never really work. Yeah, other things though work quite well. Fake news sources, propaganda, but almost more important is while you're watching that stir fry recipe, how much is TikTok learning about you? And how much, you know, leverage might they have that way on people in America? So, you know, I'm sort of sounding dystopic here, and I don't mean to. I mean to say we don't know. These are really uncharted waters. And I have to say, I'm not sure that a bunch of, you know, elderly, highly trained lawyers who all went to Harvard and Yale are the right people to answer these questions or even understand them. So in the TikTok oral arguments, we saw some of this. The justices were trying to be sensible. They're trying to be reasonable. And one of the things they were trying to do was to be open to the government's argument that there are national security or potential security issues here. And just because, you know, we can't tell you exactly what they are right this minute doesn't mean they aren't real threats. And that's a very valid position. What made it a little bit disturbing is that it's an approach that has nothing to do with actual current First Amendment doctrine. Current First Amendment doctrine would have said, you have to ask, is this the most narrowly tailored possible way to achieve your goal? And the answer is forcing TikTok to be sold by ByteDance is not the most narrowly tailored way. So on the one hand, the discussion seemed realistic, perhaps, or at least sensible. On the other hand, it's not. It's back to this sort of radicalism, not meant as an insult, but meant as an observation. We're in a period of radical change where, in addition to separation of powers questions and regulatory authority questions, questions about things like the First Amendment as they apply in cyberspace are also likely to undergo a radical revision. And this court seems open to doing that. The concern is that they're open to doing that without having enough background, enough understanding, or hearing enough discussion of the issues to do it responsibly and carefully.
It seems that national security concerns aside, and of course they're justifiable and large in the TikTok case, when it comes to social media, you could make the case if you wanted to knock out any particular company, whether it's Meta or something else, you could say it's causing some kind of harm.
Sure. So this is a really classic case. The government could do real harm here by making up scare cases, like as you're describing. Oh, we think Meta is bad for adolescents, we're going to shut it down, right? The government could overuse its power that way. And most of First Amendment doctrine is designed to prevent that. Most of classical and modern First Amendment rules are meant to prevent the government from throwing around its power too much. What the law is not good at recognizing is the extent to which private corporations are also nowadays extraordinarily powerful. Meta can do real harms potentially. TikTok can do real harms potentially. These are entities that are not necessarily less influential or powerful than the government itself. And so on the one hand, we want to prevent the government from being able to use, you know, exaggerated fears of national security or the well-being of adolescents or whatever is the concern of the day, exaggerating those fears and using them as weapons to shut down businesses. On the other hand, those fears may be real. And we want government, which is what we call the entity that we use to try and make rules, right, to be able to prevent those harms. And the difficulty right now, I think, is that it's very, very difficult to articulate where that balance lies. And the TikTok case is the first, or not the first, there were a couple last year actually, but it's a very publicly visible, very big case that involves addressing those questions. There will be many more. And I don't think that this year, or certainly the next, you know, by the time we're 2 or 3 years from now, I think we'll have seen substantial and significant revisions to major, major doctrinal areas. That's that radical change I was talking about. as the Roberts Court tries to wrestle with these new and very challenging questions.
What role, especially in the Roberts Court, does the Chief Justice play? We refer to it as the Roberts Court. Does he have a philosophy that we think will guide the court in some of these issues?
So that's a wonderful question for court historians. We call courts after the Chief Justices, to be honest, for convenience. It's just a way of keeping, you know, in the same way we talk about presidential administrations. There's a wonderful, wonderful story about when Eisenhower was first elected president. And Truman was supposed to have said, oh, poor Ike, he'll get here, he'll say, do this, do that, and nothing will happen. Because Eisenhower had been a general and very busy, different being a president. You know, it's not the case, for better or worse, that during a presidential administration, everything that happens reflects the personal views of that president, or it varies by president, let's put it that way. I think we have a sense in the Trump administration this will be more true than it's been true in some recent administrations. The same is true of courts. Some chief justices have had a very powerful influence on shaping the vision and voice of the court. For others, it feels like just a label. Roberts initially people thought of Roberts as kind of very much being a voice of the court, and it would be institutionalist and modern and careful. And then he became the swing vote on the court, and it was considered his court that way, and that there were four extreme conservatives and four progressives, and he always or often had a lot of freedom to design his exact position, and whichever four he wanted to align with would have to come along. At this point, after the three Trump appointees, it's not clear in what sense this is Roberts' court at all. It's really much more Alito's and Gorsuch's and Kavanaugh's, if I had to pick three off the top of my head, with very strong inputs from Thomas and Barrett. It's a very right-wing court. There's a great deal to be said about our system of nomination and appointment that results in a single president appointing three justices and other presidents appointing none, and whether this is a good or a bad thing. But certainly one of the things that this system can result in and has resulted in is a dramatic ideological swing in the court in a very short period of time. In President Trump's first term, he was able to appoint three justices. He appointed three strongly ideological justices, very conservative justices, along with the existing conservatives on the court. They are now a very solid majority without Roberts. So his leverage in terms of, you know, if you don't do X or Y, I won't join your opinion, is very much diminished. Now, on the one hand, we shouldn't overstate this. I'm always troubled when we use conservative and liberal to talk about justices, not because those terms don't mean anything, but they don't perfectly track the way we use the same words when we're talking about partisan politics or policy. They mean something, but it's a little bit different. And quite often on certain issues, we see lineups that cross those lines. But on a series of very core issues, in particular the ones we've just been talking about, there really is a very clear, very staunchly, very conservative majority on this court. And Roberts is only loosely part of it. So calling this his court, you know, is kind of limited. He's becoming a bit of a figurehead. And I have to, if I may speculate, I have to imagine that's a matter of great frustration for him, because he has always viewed himself as a great institutionalist, a guy who'll preserve the dignity and autonomy of the court. I think he really believed what he was saying during his confirmations when he said, you know, I have no intention of being an ideological actor. I want to reduce the level to which judges make contentious decisions. Instead, he's found himself presiding over and frankly participating in some of the most contentious, most divisive, and most politically explosive decisions by a Supreme Court in the last 50 years.
Well, not to get too far into the history, but it seems as if the politics in the Supreme Court has been there from the beginning.
Oh, absolutely. But there, as in so many things in American politics, these things go in periods. So, you know, if we go back to the election of 1800, in the election of 1800, one of the big issues was that Adams and the Federalists had been packing the court with their justices. When Jefferson came in, one of the first things he did is try to get rid of them by abolishing judgeships and challenging appointments. And this becomes the case of Marbury versus Madison that certainly some of our listeners, I'm sure, know. Right. So at the very beginning, it was intensely contentious. During the Warren Court in the 60s and 70s, you know, there was a court that on questions of rights and on the questions of the federal government's power to enforce civil rights took very, very broad, very liberal, small l, views. And that upset people. Brown versus Board of Education upset people. The adoption of the Voting Rights Act and its approval by the Supreme Court upset a lot of people. And you began to have things like people putting up signs, impeach Earl Warren.
Yes, all through the South in particular.
All through the South. Then there was a lengthy period of certainly not stasis or peace and quiet, but broad consensus. Not on everything by any means. It was never the case that, to take one example, it was never the case that abortion was not a contentious issue before the court after the 1970s, after the late 1970s. But in the kinds of things that we've been talking about, separation of powers, how the government works, the powers constitution as opposed to the rights constitution, the fundamental structure of how American government works under our constitution, those things seemed very settled from the 1940s until 2 years ago. And that's not really a coincidence. In American history, law and politics are never separate. In the 1980s, a conservative movement, this includes the election of Ronald Reagan, the start of the Federalist Society, people like Bork and Scalia and Mies, who really launched the originalist revolution, part of that political movement was a desire to limit the federal government and scale back the New Deal's version of an administrative state. Part of doing that is reconceiving the legal and constitutional doctrines that establish those limits. So in one sense, this is a crisis or a conflict that's been brewing for 30 or 40 years. It's the legal side of a much bigger political constitutional conflict over what kind of national government should we have. In another way, though, it's striking how abruptly and how quickly those questions have come to be considered serious. In politics, they talk about the Overton window. It's the window of what can be said and be considered reasonable. And at any given time, and it moves. Things that sounded crazy 30 years ago sound normal now, and vice versa. Well, there's a legal version of the same thing. It's sometimes called the on-the-wall and off-the-wall. What's an off-the-wall legal argument? Well, arguments that were off-the-wall 20 years ago are absolutely central to the Supreme Court's proceedings now. And so, although it's quite true that the political story behind that goes back 30 or 40 years, or in some ways goes back all the way to the New Deal and resistance to the New Deal, the more specific story about the court and the issues it's addressing looks much more radical and much more abrupt.
And speaking of abrupt, we will have some time to touch bases on two really large issues before the court in the coming year: presidential immunity and immigration and federalism, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Howard Schwaber, and we're looking at Supreme Court cases that are likely to be very important things to watch in the coming year. A couple of big ones that we must get to in the time remaining, and one of them has to do, I think, with the power of the federal government versus the power of state governments when it comes to immigration.
Absolutely. So, I mean, and we're all, I think, trembling with anticipation to see what President Trump will actually do on his first day. And I say that just because he said so many things that he insists he will do on his first day. You know, if it only takes until the end of his first week, will we be disappointed? But certainly, one area in which Trump has been steadfast and consistent is that he intends to do dramatic things with respect to immigration. Now, the scope of that goal is becoming increasingly unclear. During the campaign, it was, we're going to deport 11 million people. Now it's, well, we're going to deport only criminals, but also criminals with minor offenses, and then we'll see what happens after that. Except that some people in the incoming administration are saying different things. But I think it's certainly clear that there's going to be a very major effort to deport a large number of people and to close the border. That's a core issue for Trump's supporters and for he himself, and it's going to be a core policy goal for this administration. Well, in previous eras, in the ancient history of, say, 10 years ago, we might have asked whether this is a separation of powers problem, whether Congress has authorized the president to do quite as much as Trump wants to do with his departments, or whether Congress would go along with the things that a president, in this case Trump, might want to do. This year, none of that seems terribly relevant. Congress has given the executive enormous powers in this area, which I should point out have been exercised vigorously by Obama and Biden as well. Obama had the previous record for deportations during his administration. In fact, there are more deportations during the Obama administrations than during the first Trump administration, which is a statistic that shocks a lot of people who don't work in this area. Among immigration lawyers, Obama used to be known as the deporter in chief. But Trump plans, or says he plans, again, I certainly take him seriously on this point, plans to do some dramatic things. Where the pushback is likely to come is from states and cities. We're already beginning to see, you know, threats and counter threats. So the governor of California is claiming he's going to Trump-proof the state of California. I really don't know exactly what that means or what he thinks it means, but it's certainly a declaration of an intent to oppose the policy goals of the Trump administration. Immigration will be front and center. Incoming members of the Trump administration, particularly Homeland Security and immigration, have said, we will take legal action against state governments or against cities in particular that try to resist our deportation efforts. If you think about the sanctuary cities idea, I think Madison actually is formerly a sanctuary city. There will be, I'm sure, major showdowns in which the federal government will try to pressure or punish those sanctuary cities. And there's a few ways they might try to do that, and every single one of them will end up in court. So for example, can the federal government say, well, if you want to be a sanctuary city and interfere with our policies, you can do that, but we're going to cut federal funding on this or that area. Those are called spending conditions. And there's a whole body of law about when the government may and may not impose those sorts of conditions. It last came up in a really big way on the Affordable Care Act during the Obama presidency. I'm expecting to see more of that because I'm expecting to see the Trump administration use those spending conditions as a lever against non-compliant cities and states. Trump has the authority, particularly with the consent of governors, to call up National Guard forces in order to enforce federal law. There's always been something terribly ironic about people who describe the idea of the militia in the Constitution as something to resist the federal government. The Constitution says the militia may be called up to enforce federal law. George Washington called up militias from three states and led them into Pennsylvania to put down the Whiskey Rebellion. So the militias, even before there was a National Guard, were instruments of federal enforcement. Particularly with the governor's consent, there's nothing that prevents Donald Trump from calling up the National Guard from, say, Texas, Florida, Georgia, and Mississippi. And for reasons I can't explain, Georgia has one of the largest National Guard contingents in the country, and sending them into California to try and force San Francisco to stop interfering with deportations. I know that sounds fanciful, but in fact, it is entirely and clearly within the current understanding of the president's powers. Now, I don't know if Trump would do something quite that dramatic, but if you remember the protests at Lafayette Square in Washington, D.C., he did something really interesting. He called up a federal force that was not regular federal forces. It was Park Police and Capitol Police. It was sort of a cobbled together force of secondary federal units and use them as a police force. That's a precedent. I mean, that shows a creativity in making use of the wide array of forces that are available. So I think there will be issues about spending conditions. I think at some point there will be issues about direct conflicts and clashes. And potentially there could be any number of other issues which will turn the national issue of immigration into a constitutional issue of federalism. How much can the federal government force states to do things they don't want to do? And, you know, there's a certain irony here that historically, that's usually been a liberal or progressive national government trying to force reactionary states to do things they don't want to do. And now the shoe is on the other foot, and there will be plenty of people who may be given a moment to regret their earlier arguments about the power the federal government ought to have. The immunity question is honestly much more narrow. The Supreme Court's ruling on Trump's immunity was startling. I don't. It's shocking, not in the sense of terrible, but shocking in the sense that it shocked. It went much further than anyone reasonably expected. Trump has an extraordinary, historically unprecedented, and future presidents have, a previously unprecedented level of immunity. Somewhere the ghost of Richard Nixon is watching this conversation. And we have had presidents in the past who engaged in outright criminality. And, again, let's wait and see where this goes. But theoretically, the door is open for some fairly ugly sorts of things. And I'll give you one example. Trump has announced that the Trump family will not cease making foreign contracts during his presidency.
Which is a violation of the Constitution?
Not necessarily, no. It would be if it became something of value going to the president. There's what's called the emoluments clause, that the president must not receive value from foreign powers. It could turn into something that looks rather like, bribery, if it goes far enough. And for anything of that sort, Trump is now completely immune, which is, well, I think what adjective you use at this point really reflects your politics, but certainly will be interesting to watch. So are there any limits to this immunity? Once again, the Roberts Court has issued a dramatic, radical statement with very few signs about what are the limits on this principle. This is one more example of that same thing. Will we see a case in which something comes up and the question of whether Trump could be criminally liable for his actions while in office is considered? We'll see. That would be awfully interesting.
Will it come down to just making a distinction between official and unofficial acts, though?
Well, it comes down to that, but what makes it much more complicated is that part of the ruling that the Supreme Court made had to do with the question of whether evidence of official acts could be used to demonstrate, for example, a motive for an unofficial act. So in the process, right, so in the process of trying to bring a prosecution against the president, well, this was true of the January 6th prosecutions in the Jack Smith report that just came out. If that report had been the basis for a criminal indictment, and if that indictment had relied on information and evidence where that information related to official acts, whether or not the charges did, could that evidence be used? And the answer is maybe.
What happens then in terms of immunity and a former president?
We may have to answer these questions in ways we have never had to answer them before. Up until this time, the pardon power has kept us out of this particular quagmire. Ford pardoned Nixon. George H.W. Bush pardoned the Iran-Contra conspirators. Many people theorize it's because he was one of them, but even leaving that aside, which ended an investigation that could have that was already inside the White House. Trump's immunity doesn't extend to people who work for him, but one of the things that's part of his official business is the pardon power. And so one of the things, I realize it sounds like we're talking about a mafia movie here, but this is the weird world we're living in. One of the things the Supreme Court ruling means is that there is no possible way to assert criminal liability for a president, let's call him Donald Trump, on the basis that he's giving out pardons in order to effectuate illegal conduct. I know. Let me try it this way. In the play Beckett, there's a very famous line where the king says, "Will no one rid me of this meddlesome priest?" And his courtiers go off and kill him, right? And the king says, "I never told you to do that." Call it the Beckett rule. Under Supreme Court immunity, the king can say, "Go kill this meddlesome priest, and then I'll pardon you." And he can say that in advance. And there's no possibility of that being a basis for criminal liability because pardoning is an official act.
There's no, I don't want to use the word Trump, but there's nothing that can turn over a pardon?
No, there's not. Now, the one thing that could limit all this would be if the Supreme Court issued a new ruling that somehow tempered or identified a limiting principle. I mean, during the oral arguments in that case, it was extraordinary. A lawyer for the government was asked, a lawyer arguing in favor of the immunity, was asked, you know, does this mean that the president could order the murder of a political rival and be immune? And his answer was yes.
Yeah, so to use a SEAL team to murder somebody.
Use SEAL Team 6 to kill a rival. And the answer is yes, he'd be completely criminally immune in that situation. Now, I find it very difficult to believe that the majority intended that. In fact, Roberts, in his opinion, said, oh, well, these are fanciful. Right? We don't need to think about these things.
Want to bet?
Well, right. I mean, we don't need to unless and until we have to. And when that time comes, you know, perhaps a new ruling we've made will say that will say, well, obviously we didn't mean X, Y, Z. And, you know, a principle will be announced. But that's what I was talking about earlier. This court has a habit of issuing really sweeping, totalizing statements with no indication of what are the factors, what's the, you know, what are the tests, what are the limits, and then leaving it for some unnamed future date to work out those things. Right now, on this whole range of issues, we're in that intermediate period where dramatic rules have been announced, limiting principles have not. And so we're waiting to see the process play out to see where the rule actually settles in the way it will actually be enforced and applied.
And regardless of who becomes president in 2029, we're very likely to have just about the same Supreme Court.
Absolutely. You know, the discussion of our court and term limits and aging in place and other issues like that, it would be a whole additional show. I think here's a takeaway that's really worth considering. Our system, for long, complicated historical reasons, and today we have a system in which amending the Constitution is essentially impossible, certainly in any substantive way. As a result, the only way changes in constitutional understanding happen is through changes in the personnel of the Supreme Court.
The interpretation.
Exactly. And so as a result of that, and you know, there's a parallel here with the stakes in state judicial elections. The stakes in these elections, like the stakes in the Supreme Court nominations, have become much, much higher. And much more attention is being paid to appointments and to what constitutional vision they will promote, because they really are the final word in the way the system currently exists. And with lifetime tenure and the coincidences of multiple appointments in a single term, right, and everything that goes with that, and the move toward appointing younger justices, the court that we, the conservative majority in the court that we have in place today is likely, barring something truly tragic occurring, to be in place for a very long time to come.
Howard Schwaber, always a pleasure.
Mine too. Thank you again.
I'm Norman Gilliland, and our engineers are Lee Rayburn and Jeff Reynolds, and I hope you'll join me next time around for University of the Air.